Hi everyone, welcome back to the Arkademia podcast, the platform where we talk all things architecture. Today we've got a very special edition of the podcast with our first ever guest from award-winning practice Strom Architects, their founding director, Magnus Strom. Hi Magnus, thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast. To start us off, would you just give us and our audience a bit of a background in where you grew up and stuff and how you became to fall in love with architecture?
All right. Thank you, first of all, for having me on the podcast. So I grew up in Sweden my parents were always interested in architecture. And as long as I can remember, since I was 5 years old, I actually wanted to be an architect. And I suppose it's quite unusual to know that from such a from early in your childhood. But in Sweden, the whole modernism or functionalism, as it's called in Sweden, was something that was very kind of welcomed, and it became part of everyday life. So you were all the time exposed to architecture, whether it was in your school or your swimming pool. And, you know, and I always remember how that was something that really influenced me as a child, and I was very interested in it. And then, unfortunately, you know, going to school in Sweden, there was only 3 schools of architecture in Sweden, and you had to have top grades across the board to get in, which I didn't do. I did like you can do a test to get in, and I did passed the first test, but not the second one. So I kind of slightly gave up my hopes on becoming an architect until I then thought, crikey, I've wasted a few years now after school. It's actually what I want to do. So that meant that I had to go abroad and do it. And in 95, Sweden became members of the European Union. So that was like happy days, because it meant that I could go study abroad. So I applied to a few schools in the UK and I got accepted in all of them. By one I applied, so I thought, yeah, why not? Let's do that. So that's how I came about coming to England to study. And I ended up studying in Portsmouth, the Portsmouth School of Architecture. And yeah, I didn't really know anything about it at that time or about the school, really. It was a bit of a lucky dip. I wanted to be by the sea, and I happened to end up in Portsmouth because it was closer to the airport than Plymouth. I felt very lucky because there was a really good period. I think they had a golden era which I managed to hit, where there was, you know, Professor Sir Colin Stansfield Smith was a professor of architecture. It was numerous really, really great tutors, and it was like a period for 10 years when a lot of exciting thing happened there. That I think they had the highest numbers of firsts in the UK, for example, on the degree. So it was a really great place to study, and that's how I got started.
That's great. It's so interesting to hear that, you know, that you had to go abroad basically to do what you loved. You know, obviously it's different here. So many universities offering the architecture course. In terms of you guys, obviously being homebirds, you both studied at Liverpool. There was no desire to move anywhere for you guys.
Well, we were quite fortunate with that regard. So probably a similar story with myself, Magnus, that I probably wouldn't have got the grades to get into like a really top end university. But luckily at the time, we've got 2 universities, Liverpool and John Moores, and John Moores had a less stringent criteria. So I actually got in John Moores, and it allowed me to basically bypass the first key gateway, which is the grades. And then I think once you're in university, it doesn't really matter after that. You find your own way. And that was sort of my experience. And I was similar in regard that I wanted to be an architect from a very early age. And it was from primary school when I learnt about St. Paul's Cathedral and Christopher Wren. And I always knew I wanted to do it. And I've always felt quite fortunate in that regard that not a lot of people know what they want to do. And I always geared me learning towards that.
Pretty much the day me and Jack met, we said we'd have a practice one day as well, didn't we? So
feel
quite fortunate ourselves. But I suppose, Kenny, what you're getting at there is, you know, fair play to you, Magnus. It's quite a brave move to have moved abroad, especially the architecture in Sweden's a lot better than the architecture over here.
That's both true and not true, I think. When I came here, I had no idea about, you know, architecture or anything at all. You know, I knew I was interested in it, but, you know, as you study, your interest grows. And that thing, as you said, like, you know, if we employ someone, do I care where they went to university? Do I care if they went to the AA or Bartlett or, you know, or whatever? No, I don't, actually. It's all about the portfolio and what they've done. That's so much more important. And, you know, that's, yeah, so that's cool. And what you really need is to find one tutor. You only really need to have one tutor that's going to inspire you and really kind of, you're going to pick up on something and you can develop something you run with. It doesn't so much matter so much where you are. And, you know, I've taught at uni as well. So it's that relationship with your tutors. And, you know, you need to find someone that you can latch on to, someone that can open your eyes to something and guide you. And I think that goes through your whole life, that you can have mentors and or business consultants at different stages that keep pushing you.
Yeah. It's probably quite refreshing for the younger listeners to hear that as well. You know, who probably think, oh, I'm not going to be able to get into like the AA. And yeah. It doesn't really matter. Like, because if then they look on Strom's site, the houses, the producing are exceptional. Yeah, and you can get there by your own way, can't you? Not the traditionally prescribed way,
yeah,
so to speak.
Yeah, and this is something I've always kind of instilled in junior staff in our practice as well. To be a great architect, it is kind of from within, isn't it? In terms of that determination to just be the best you can, all that sort of stuff. And again, that was obviously we had a little chat off air beforehand, and that was what I was saying about something that we're trying to get across with Arcademia as well, is trying to inspire people There are a lot of downsides to being an architect. It's quite stressful and sort of stuff. But I am of the opinion that if you keep striving to, if we're just on a practice level, if you continue to improve the quality of your clients and the quality of your service, and something that we'll touch on a bit as well is obviously on your website, you're very deliberate in your process. And I bet you that contributed to the quality of project that you find yourself on today. And I think that's an important message as well. The route to there isn't as important as, you know, how you kind of use your skills and your own determination to kind of get there. So
yeah, I mean, I think that determination, as you say, is very important, and that comes, you know, something we probably talk about a little bit later. But you know, what is it that actually works, and you know, in that process, and how do you know where you want to go? And it's like I've always been very focused, and I used to do a lot of sports at quite a high level when I was younger, and I think that you're determined and you're working towards a goal, whether it is your degree or your first job or where you want to go set up your practice. I've always, you know, in a weird way, I've had, you know, one year goal or 3 year goal or a 10 year goal. I mean, right now I've run out of goals, so I feel a bit rudderless. But when you have all of these goals and you've got something to work for, and it's the same thing when you have a practice, you've got to figure out where you want to go. Where is the destination? Where do I want to be? You know, where do I want my practice to be in 10 years time? And if you don't know that, how do you know where to go? You know, and it's that journey to get to that place. You know, you know, some people might be lucky to fly there or teleport there. Some people, you know, may have to hitchhike all the way or cycle or walk there. And it takes, you know, everyone has got a different way of getting to that destination, where it is they want to do. And it's numerous different ways. There's no right way. There's no wrong way. But that is the thing that changes. But the destination is the same. And if you've got that goal in mind the whole time, you should hopefully reach that one day.
Yeah,
spot yeah, on. And you, so I'm sorry to think about, you know, because the stuff you're talking about there, 5 year plans, and well, without that, you don't know what your practice will look like and stuff. And our practice has been going for 6 years now. I think we've probably only just about landed now on what our original vision was. I think as a new business owner, you've got to kind of just take on a lot, haven't you, and try different things. And I feel like we're just starting to find our ground now, and we'll get to it in a moment. But I think we do want to just dig a little bit deeper on how you emphasize to clients the importance of your process and for them to stick to your process as well. But we'll get to that in a bit. Yeah, but personally, I'm fascinated by that bit.
Yeah. I mean, you know, yeah. No, I was going to say, you know, I think we're lucky. You know, when you work up a portfolio, you obviously clients get attracted. So by the time they come to you, you're kind of halfway won already. And that makes that process a lot easier because they've seen a product that they like and they go like, do you know what? I want something like that. And that means that, you know, 90% of your competition goes away.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Just to take it back a little bit then. So I wanted to ask you what your part one and part two experiences were like. So we get a lot of engagement from our audience on when they're moving out from the degree and into part one, and similar with masters and part two, and just asking for advice and stuff on what to expect. And the guys here, Adam and Jack, they had different experiences. So I just wanted to touch briefly on yours. How was it for you when you first stepped out and you first took up a position in a practice?
I loved it. I absolutely loved studying architecture. We were a great bunch of friends as well. And when I first started in the beginning, I didn't know what a tracing paper was, what pencil you should use or anything. You know, I remember that quite clearly. But the whole process of being that studio driven, you know, sometimes you work in the studio, sometimes you worked at home, but that having that project based, that half the course was project based. And that was a fun bit. The rest of the stuff was just stuff I felt like you had to get through, which was the school, you know, the history of architecture or technology or, you know, theory and all of that. I was, for me, it was the design that was the interesting thing and running the project. And it was just something that really kind of, I loved that whole process of going home and drawing and modeling and just building physical models because, you know, in my degree, you know, this is how old I am, right? We didn't really use computers so much. So I started in 95 in School of Architecture. And, you know, we had computer education, which I hated. So I was drawing everything by hand and, you know, set up perspectives on my wall and so on. And it was interesting, but I loved the whole degree experience. And, you know, and as you kind of developed skills, you kind of got like almost like you got a set of tools. And then when you had those set of tools, you could start using them. You started understanding certain principles. And, you know, there's certain elements perhaps in your education where you find something that unlocks something and you learn a lot from it. So for me, for example, I remember finding Farnsworth House in my second year and just having that pavilion architecture with the volume inside that, you know, that it kind of contains something, it defines space, it separates space and all of that, that was super interesting for me. So that did a lot for me. So degree, yeah, I mean, that was great. I can't complain, you know, I was, fantastic. And then obviously went on to doing a year out where I first worked in London at McCaslin and Partners. And it was, yeah, that was, I found that very hard because you know, I was earning £12,500 a year, and you didn't have enough money, so you ate like Tesco value bread with jam for breakfast, your packed lunch kind of thing. Otherwise, you couldn't afford to drink any beers, right? So you have to prioritize. But I wasn't there, because you know we all have different things. What's important to us when we're young? And then I went to finish my year out in Winchester in a practice called Architecture PLB, and they had a quite close connection with Portsmouth School of Architecture. And I think anyone in Hampshire probably worked there at some stage, or, you know, there's lots of people that worked there that set up practices and so on. And that was a really good learning curve because I really learned to use a computer there. And that was such an important skill then when coming back into diploma, to be able to just fly with the computer straight away. That was super important. And we used Vectorworks and we 3D model in Vectorworks back then as well. And I also worked part-time there throughout my whole diploma, my whole dip one. I worked 2-3 days a week. So that was really good. And again, you know, that more beer money. And then, you know, through I think I worked a little bit in my dip two as well, but I dropped that then when it came to the thesis. When we started diploma, I was toying with the idea of perhaps going somewhere else. But for me, it was like I had all removed country once, and I didn't feel like, you know, moving again. I was quite keen on trying Spain or something, but I just thought it was too much. I thought I'll hang out and stay in Portsmouth. Diploma one, I thought it was quite difficult because we did a lot of urban studies and urban master planning and all of that kind of stuff that didn't interest me. So I think it was hard to muster up that kind of energy to do that. But then when we did Diploma 2 and we had a dissertation to write and a thesis to do, you could do what you wanted. And that I absolutely loved that because you could spend so much time in really doing what you wanted and exploring it and testing ideas and, you know, just building models or whatever it was. And that was a fabulous idea. And, you know, great, really, you know, I got nominated for the silver medal for that as well. So, yeah, it was like all-around positive experience. And then I ended up going to work for my external examiner after that in Dublin, to like a Mamar. That was a great experience for me.
Yeah, that sounds brilliant. How was Dublin, by the way? How did you find that? How long were you there?
Yeah, I was in Dublin for a year after I graduated from Dip 1 and before I got one of my old tutors from Portsmouth. He asked me to join him because he had worked on his own while teaching as well. So he asked me to join his practice. And so I was one of his first employees. So I was there for 8 years before I set up on my own.
Yeah.
Wow. And is that because you stood out as a student? Did you stand out? You know, because obviously an external examiner. I know that's quite a tricky one to sort of judge, but.
I did probably, you know, I did have some very good grades in my Diploma 2 and obviously getting the silver nomination was fantastic. And John Maher, he was one of the principals of Blackham & Maher. He had previously hired people from Portsmouth, so it was people from previous year that had been there and so on. So he was almost kind of following on the tradition where he would pick up a few students. And it was just a great place to work in Dublin as well. We did some fantastic one-off houses, and they did a lot of one-off houses, both in Ireland and in Ibiza, for example, and around Europe. So it was kind of followed on a theme that I was very interested in, work on private houses.
Yeah. Would you say at that stage in your career, your signature style was sort of evident by that point? I know you mentioned like Farnsworth House, and you can see in some of your projects that they're similar to some, you know, like Mies van der Rohe, they're quite minimalist. Would you say that was shining through at that stage, or did it come a bit later?
No, I think that was something that came later, but I think that when I was at John Pardee Architects, I mean, I must have been involved in 20, 25 houses over those years I was there. So you really kind of hone your skills in terms of, understanding space and how family home works and what you need and what you don't need and how all that works together. So a lot of those things about the brief and so on, it almost becomes second nature by now, I would say. But the signature style, I don't think that came on until much later. And I remember after I set up my practice, you kind of sit there and you got your, I worked from home for a few years, but you kind of get a design and you go like, oh, what am I going to do now? It's no one, I got to do this on my own and I got to do it. What do I actually stand for? And I remember what I did was I went back to my thesis and my dissertation and I reread what that was about. And it was almost about, I was striving for a clarity in what we were doing. I was never an architect that kind of fancied the whole Zaha Hadid kind of shape finding thing. Instead, it was based on 4 points really, which was construction. How are you going to build this building? Is it a concrete frame or a steel frame or a load bearing masonry or timber or whatever? Construction and details. How do all of those different bits come together? And then materials, what are the materials that you come together into details and how is it ordered? So it was quite a pragmatic approach. But then I realized as well, that it's kind of not enough because you can be very pragmatic about something, but you need to add a little bit of, something that is beyond that. And that's where design came from. And for me, very much, it is, lots of architects start by space planning and it grows from a plan. Whereas I think that we want the buildings to work as more of a free form in a way where we're trying to find a geometry or a shape that works that's strong in its own right. And I think that's where more of that kind of signature in a way came from, that you could hopefully recognize some common theme in our buildings and how they work together.
Yeah, there's real consistency there, isn't it? And it is lovely, the stuff that you guys do, and you can almost tell it's a strong building when you see it. Adam, you particularly have followed them for years, haven't you?
Yeah. I'm fanboying a little bit. Got my mouth just wide open when I'm listening to you. But you know what? This is a little off gender a touch, but there is a debate, isn't there, about style? Whether should you have a style or should it be a little unique per project? And I've actually always been of the opinion that you should have a style. And it's something that we've tried to do over the years is you do want to you want to have a recognisable building. More locally to us, there's a great practice called Shed KM, and they always put a splash of yellow on their projects, and you can just tell that. And I do think that's important. And again, that just something that I love seeing about your philosophy is, it isn't just about style, it's about a philosophy and a process and all that sort of stuff. And you clearly believe in that. And just, again, just for the benefit of our audience, would that be your piece of advice in terms of you would encourage others to generate at least a philosophy? It doesn't have to be the same looking thing, but at least get a philosophy nailed down and try and pursue that.
Yeah, I think so. And it's the same thing. It's like when I have a discussion with people here in the office that work here, and I keep trying to say like, We talk a lot about what our ethos is and what it is that, is important to us. And, they're always like, oh, is that very strong or isn't it? And that's something that we try to think about, that ethos. And it's like I always say to them when they're designing something, don't do what you think I would do, because you need to understand the philosophy and then apply yourself as an architect to work within that framework almost. It's almost like the better we can define what that is, it's almost like these tram lines, whatever, the better people understand that, the more freedom they have. So there's definitely, there has to be a style or style. I mean, I think that there's variation, but there needs to be an identity or something. I think that's very important. And I think for us, that's also helped about being a niche practice in a way, because it narrows down. So you become more focused and defined for sure. And it's about curating as well. You know, designing for me is about curating. I think I'm a better curator than a designer. And what I mean by that is that it's very easy to recognize something, whether it's good or bad. And I think that because you keep recognizing that, you never kind of give up. You keep pushing. Even when you finish a project, you only see kind of the thing that's wrong sometimes. You keep that process of curating all the time and trying to refine and make things better. And that's another thing that keeps driving forward continuously.
Yeah, no, that's great, yeah. Great advice. Moving in then, just while we're now talking about the practice and the ethos and stuff, tell us about the start. So how did you come up with the idea of starting your own practice? What was that born out of? And was it a difficult process that you went through, or was it something that you found quite easy?
Well, I mean, I think I went after I graduated and so on, and I worked in that job for 8 years. I was a director there before I set up, and I kind of became comfortable. And I kind of gave up a little bit or forgot what my dream was. And then the recession hit in 2008, 2009. And that, I think, loads of practices came out of that for different reasons. But it just came a time when you think, like, I want to do this for myself because I want to push this idea and I push that idea. And sometimes that was perhaps not encouraged. So it was time to do it. But I think that then also setting up was... some people do it very deliberately, whereas I don't think I did. I had a working drawings package for a house I designed in my previous package to do and deliver it, which I did. And then I got another project, and I was lucky to get a new build house as well. But it was challenging because I was trying to get a lot of other work as well. I was trying to get educational work because I had experience in that, and you're trying to do lots of different things. And I think that with hindsight, you're trying to do too many things, and you need to have much more of a laser focus, which I kind of did develop. And for me, a catalyst for that was that when we had done a few houses and projects, and we had a few things on the books that we were working on, and I got an inquiry to do a £20 million house in Ukraine. And I thought, hang on, I can't get a £20,000 extension to a school in Hampshire, but people are asking me to do a luxury house in Ukraine. And I thought, like, well, it's obvious, you know, to me. Then we decided to be a niche practice and specialize on one-off houses. And that is, being niche, I think, is one thing that can be a real key to making it and not making it, because clients are going to come to you, they're going to say, like, oh, they're specialists in this field, they feel comfortable in that, rather than you've done, you know, 10 different things. But if you've done one thing 10 times, that becomes something that's very, it's reassuring for clients. So niche thing is a very good thing. And the funny thing about that is, like, now, because we've been in that niche field for quite a while and working on the high-end resi, that's now spilling into other stuff. So that's by being niche and getting, taking a market share and being like, I mean, a thought leader is perhaps the wrong word, but we have a profile now and a brand which kind of goes beyond that. So it means that we have started to do a few housing developments, luxury house and houses. We've done a scheme in Turkey, for example, of 6 houses. We've done a scheme in Turks and Caicos in the Caribbean of 6 houses. And we just finished a paid competition for 60 houses in the Middle East. So it's all kind of expanding into a much bigger thing. And tomorrow we have a meeting on a big luxury development of houses in another one in the Middle East, for example. So that's kind of spreading out into that hospitality sector, which is very interesting for us, because I can see that as where the practice can develop. And I said earlier that 10-year plan is kind of come to an end, and now we're looking at that next chapter, what's going to happen in the next 10 years. So I think it's a very natural direction for us to go to do keep doing the houses, but moving into doing the houses on a much more on a bigger scale within the development framework.
Yeah, this is fascinating stuff as well, because obviously we're talking about...
This is good for us as anyone else.
It's fascinating because we're talking about being business people now rather than just architects. And obviously when you start your own practice, the vision that you have certainly when we started anyway, was that we were going to be our masters of our own fate. We designed lovely buildings, but it was still very much centered around being architects. And what we very quickly learned was that, no, you're a businessman first now. You know, you have to get these structures in place. You have to go out and win work, network, and you're not just at your desk designing pretty buildings anymore. There's a lot more that goes into it. And that was the hard learning curve that we had. And that's why it's fascinating to hear, you know, you talking about your journey and stuff. And just on that, I know the guys are as intrigued as I am by all this stuff. But one thing I wanted to ask you is, winning work when you start a practice is what I found the hardest, what the most important and hardest thing to do is to get jobs through the door. And for you to carve out that niche for yourself, how did you do it? Did you have like a marketing strategy where you had a budget that you were putting here, there and everywhere, you know, to get the name out there? Or was it more in-person networking? How did you go about that?
Well, I mean, I remember this, I listened to a lot of podcasts, and guy called Chase Jarvis, a photographer in Seattle, he always goes on saying that if you want to do a certain type of work, you've got to have that work in your portfolio. If you don't have that work in your portfolio, no one's going to hire you. So for us, you know, I had a few projects I could use in my portfolio from my previous practice. And then also, it was, for me, it was two or three things, really. One of the first things was that when I got this one-off house up in Suffolk, and I spent 25% of my fee on visualization of CGI, because I had seen this guy called Peter Guthrie, who's now a friend of mine, and he runs a very successful visualization studio in London with Henry, another friend of mine. So I employed Peter to do these CGIs. And it was just, this was like 12 years ago now, something like that. And I think that the whole really photorealistic CGI exploded about then, and you had the zine and Arc Daily, all of that kind of really took off as well. And suddenly you had a magazine like online magazine like the zine that needed to publish six stories a day, not, you know, two or three a month.
Yeah.
Like they used to do when it was like a printed magazine. So they had a much bigger hunger for a project. So that meant that they published these projects, although they weren't finished. And that was kind of one thing. So you got a lot of publicity. And then the other thing we did was I did a fictitious project, which we call Superhouse, because I have a lot of friends here in Lymington down by the coast, and they work in the design yachts in the super yachts industry. I mean, they're designing these fabulous pieces of yachts, motorboats, sailing boats that are, you know, up to 100 meters. It's insane stuff when you think about it. But I thought, like, if people spend this kind of money on boats, why wouldn't they spend it on a house? And you always thought, like, you know, there are not many people around the world that do that. So we'll do a super house. So I did a super house, what I called them. We designed this house on a fictitious bay in Ibiza and got it rendered by the boundary again. And, you know, got worldwide publicity. It was published all around the world. And I had several meetings about people said, like, oh, I want to build it, or I want to live there, or I want to buy it. And we had request from Prada. They wanted to have an annual party there. HBO wanted to shoot a TV series with Bill Farrell there. And it's like, oh, it doesn't exist. And, you know, but it was the challenge with it was that people said, like, oh, if he was real, I'd buy it, but I don't have time to find a site and I haven't time to do it. So, but it didn't really matter because it gave us a lot of publicity. And these proper trickle down effects, so it really trickled down to other projects. And we had direct commissions from that. It's like, for example, a house we're doing in the States. We did a design for a house in New Zealand. So that all came down from that. And, you know, you can't always pinpoint where things come from. But sometimes people say, like, yeah, I saw that and I want something similar.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's very much how I built it up. And then the other thing that for us was so important was the social media side. I mean, both Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. I mean, in the beginning, Facebook was quite important, and then that kind of faded away because no one's on Facebook anymore, right?
Yeah, it's Instagram now, Twitter, for us to be fine, yeah.
Yeah. except my generation and my parents kind of thing, you know, but sometimes that's not a bad thing because they got the money. I think Twitter's kind of died a death as well because it's just, you know, moaning. Twitter's for moaning. Yeah. Facebook is dead. And Instagram works really well because, you know, because we're working in the that kind of residential high-end sector and that kind of imagery goes very well on Instagram. If I was doing, say, school design, school design is not going to have the same appeal to the masses as resi design. So that has really helped us to build up the Instagram following. And, you know, we're just shy of 60,000 followers on Instagram. And that is kind of all about brand awareness. And so that means that people think about you and so on when they come to do a house or their friends want to do a house. So you kind of got that second word of mouth where someone says like, oh, yeah, we want to do a house. And then their friend would say, oh, I follow these guys on Instagram. And that's how it comes about. So we get a lot of approaches through Insta, for example. And that's all about that brand awareness, which I think is really, really important. And then, I mean, the other thing as well that is worth mentioning is like in 2014, we got this commission for a house in Swanage, which is called The Quest. That was actually, they were friends of clients that in my old practice, and they came to me directly. And that was really a nice opportunity to design a retirement home for them. And that house really kind of built on those four principles, you know, structure, details, material, and order. And it was such an easy project to understand, and it was such a clear concept. And that's why it was so successful. And it was, you know, did the whole kind of, it was on the shortlist for the house of the year, and we won another house of the year. I mean, we must have won 7-8 awards for the house. And it was on TV and so on. And that kind of, I mean, that probably still gives us work today. Yeah. Because it's in books and so on. So it still kind of just delivers for us, which is fantastic.
Yeah, it's a fantastic project.
That's my favourite, yeah, that one. Yeah.
Our producer's actually looking at it as we speak. he's absolutely blown away by it. Yeah, yeah, it is arguably your most famous project. And as you say, the power of that. And again, this is something that we pride ourselves on, that the majority of the work we win is on the back of the quality of the previous job, if you like. That is such a powerful message for our audience that, generally, you get your ducks in a row as an architect and as a designer, and say, you know, the philosophy and all, you get that right. That's a good cornerstone, isn't it, for success? Yeah.
It's a pretty good starting house as well, isn't it? And we noted that was the house that you took to the World Architecture Festival in 2014, wasn't it?
Yeah, we took it. So, I mean, like, again, it was about how do you drive up publicity and stuff like that. So I went to the World Architecture Festival in Singapore when they had the Future project. And, you know, I met loads of people there. It was kind of you're hanging out and drinking with the guys from MTA 27 and stuff. It was great. Mm. And then we went back a few years later and presented the building when it was finished. We didn't win anything, but it's still a nice experience to be there. WAF is a funny thing sometimes, I think. It's almost like, how do you compete? If you're like a building, you know, in Slough, how do you compete with in the same category with a building that's built out of bamboo sticks in Vietnam, for example? It might be in the same category because they're both schools or housing or whatever, but it's such a different thing that it's hard to compete, I think. So because everything needs an edge today, right? You can't just have a well-designed building that's not enough to win awards. It's got to have an edge. It's going to be something special about it.
Yeah. Everything's got to be got to have a level of individuality to it, haven't you? Or innovation, at least.
Obviously, it's a big decision as well to go to that festival at such an early stage in in setting up a practice. For the listeners who are probably debating a similar step and strategy, would you recommend that? Did the benefits outweigh the negatives in terms of the cost and the outlay,
terms of the brand exposure that you got from it?
The brand exposure balance out.
I do think it's worth to have that because you've got to invest to kind of do these things. So, I mean, I always kind of invested quite heavily, I think, in driving things forward. You know, instead of just taking out the money and going buying yourself a car, I did the whole super house and, you know, they had its own website and we spent a lot of the rendering and so on. So, because it's going to give you more in the future. And that's the same thing with WAF and, you know, the connections you met and the people you met. You know, for example, I met you know, Amy Frierson from Design and Marcus Fairs, and you know, and you really got to know these people, and that helped. The next time you wanted to publish something, you could pick up the phone to them or something. So I think that it's a good investment because you need to kind of be a part of it. In particular, I mean, like, it's slightly different with one-off houses because you can't exactly know where all those clients are. They need to kind of come to you. But when you're working on the more commercial side, there's so many kind of relationship building that can happen, and so on, also with, you know, developers and professional clients.
Yeah, spot on, yeah. Very well explained. Stepping into a different area of the business then. So client liaison and managing clients is obviously another very large part of our role in the day-to-day. You've won your commission and then you've got to try and get them on board with your own vision. And also you've got to try and hit their brief. And one thing I love about your ethos is the mantra that you guys have got, which is slow is steady, steady is smooth, smooth is fast. And just drilling that down into your clients. I absolutely love that as a mantra. Like, it couldn't be more true. That's the reason why, you know, but trying to convince people of that, especially if you're working in the residential sector with developers who are doing, you know, multi-story apartment schemes and stuff. Where they're trying to make the money is in the minutiae of percentages. So they're always trying to squeeze you for time and squeeze you in terms of your level of creation as well. So that mantra just couldn't be more true. And that's something that I love about Strom. But just take us through that. Like, how, you know, where did that come from for you? When did you come up with that as a strategy? And when did you start feeding that down to clients?
When did that come from? I mean, through the whole time I've had the practice, we always developed our systems and how we do things. And, you know, which is kind of culminated in this thing we call the Strom Way. And we have a really kind of, you know, I should write a book about this and franchise it, but it's really a way of now, you know, how we do or go about something. And, you know, it's our, you know, instead of having a standard, like a Ariba QA system, when it says everything that no one's going to look at the stuff in a folder, we use monday.com, and we kind of have pre-set up all these different boards that, you know, every action you need to do is almost on there. Or if it isn't there, then it refers to a checklist or something. It just means that there's a certain way that we go through a project, the way we work through a project. And I suppose the more established we become, the more kind of secure we are in saying to someone that this is the way we work. This is the way that we do it. Because otherwise, you know, clients very often think like, oh, but surely you can do it like that, or we can start building before it's finished, drawings are finished and stuff like that. And I think we've all done those things and come to, you know, live by and die by the sword, so to speak, because it's not a good way of doing it, and they're costing everyone money and everyone's getting pissed off. So I think we continuously just like update systems, and I've listened to so many podcasts and read so many books about business. And it's actually, I think it's an old U.S. Navy SEAL saying, you know, when they're kind of, when you're taking ground in battle, you know, if you just run forward, you're going to get shot and die. So if you work, you know, meticulously across the field, you know, everyone in a row, then you're going to, you know, walk slowly, steady progress, and that's going to make you the biggest gains the quickest.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's so many books out there that are great to read and just about business, and it's all kind of applicable. But I think when you read a lot of these books, after a while, you start recognizing patterns that there is kind of lots of similarities and lots of things are, you know, really work in the same way. All the people like to make their own in the different ways, but it's the same kind of backbone to it.
Yeah. Spot on. I know, Adam, there was stuff that you wanted to touch on in terms of how Strom show online as well for the clients, the wheel of stages for Ariba.
Yeah, so don't be surprised if you see an extra page on our website for with something similar, because it's one of our biggest challenges as practice owners and architects is to get that buy-in from a client on the right way to do it. And as you say, the more experienced you get, obviously you refine your own process, but I think the more confident you get in that your way is the right way. And I think, and we're almost there, aren't we? With, you know, I was with a client this week where we were saying to them that of a job of this scale, we need to start at the appropriate scale, you know, so we're at a kind of master plan stage. And at that stage, they're already asking us, well, what does the interior of the restaurant look like? And we're having to instill in them that we need to deal with the big pieces first before we rush into that. And there's a bit of friction, but generally, if you stand your ground, they do buy into it. And I think that, that those philosophies, they minimise errors. And I love the way you say, ultimately, it is a quicker process because, again, on your website, when you're explaining that process, it, you know, you say about it when it's almost when it's too late, decisions that are made on site, it's too late. And in the long run, it hurts the project, even from a time perspective, even though that's hard for clients to perceive. So I think there's a lot to be learned from that. And I think it's just such a valuable lesson that, again, if we could do it again, if we could almost set up again and go back in time. And I think from day one, and it sounds like you did do this, Magnus, in terms of you were quite decisive from the start that this is going to be our philosophy. You must have refined it, but it sounds like you had a clear philosophy from day one. If I was to be self-critical, we didn't find our philosophy until we kind of found our feet, during our process. We had an aspiration, of course, but I think only in the last 18 months, we've really got that confidence in ourselves that we've found that philosophy. So I think that's a great piece of advice for everyone. If they're either setting up or they're just, they're an architect in practice, yeah, definitely stand your ground, find your way. And I think ultimately clients will try and push you around a little bit, but I think if you do stand your ground, they generally buy into it. And have you found that yourself? Once you're clear in your process, do they generally buy into that philosophy?
I think lots of people buy into the philosophy from the beginning, but it's like our business consultant always says, it's about telling stories, right? And when the client says, can we do this? And you have so much experience now that you can say on this project, we did this and then this happened. And so we would like to do it this way because we don't want that to happen. And then you can tell that story and people buy into it. But the whole thing about, knowing if we knew everything we know now, 10 years ago, we would have set up a different business and we would have come to this place in a different way. But I'll give you an example. For example, if we say that we're going to do a working drawings package. If we just say we're going to do a working drawings package, it's a fixed fee of, say, for easy math, say it's 100K for a working drawings package. And we said, it'll take us 6 months roughly. But it's kind of, we need to have decisions out of the client. They need to decide what kind of bricks they're going to use because we don't want them to change the bricks, 5 months down the line and they change it for a different proportion and we have to redraw everything on the brick dims or they change the window system or the floor finish. We had a client that decided to change his floor to a traditionally polished concrete floor, but it was suspended timber floor in the house. So, all of decisions means that the process just take longer and longer time. And they say, you're on a fixed fee and you didn't do that. So that means that you spend 8 months instead of 6 months doing this working drawings package. So what we're trying to say now is instead of saying, what is 100K for the package, but we're going to do it at 20K over 5 months. And that's subject to you hitting this checklist that we have and that everything going green. If it goes green, we can make that decision. We can move on. But if it goes red, then basically we're running out of time. Then we'll have to extend the process. And that means you've got a flexibility in the fee structure so you don't get shafted, which has happened so many times. And I think that every architect swallows a lot of additional work that is because of changes or something like that. Or same thing if you're on site. How can you work on a fixed price? Or if you're on site, for example, it's going to take 12 months and suddenly the build takes 18 months. And should you just use the same amount of fee for that? No, it's got to be an extension to that. So again, to have a monthly arrangement as a retainer is much better. And then you can say that, for that monthly retainer, you can have, a director at 10%. You can have a project architect at 100% and assistant at 50% or whatever that is. And that's a good way of structuring it because then you can actually, when you do your fee as well, you can, resource it in a way where I know I could do it and that. So you can compare your fees resourcing wise from whether it's based on the amount of work you're going to do or the length of time or the amount of people you're going to have on it. So normally that works out pretty well.
Yeah, that's something that we implemented pretty early on was sort of a monthly retainer fee against our fees rather than stage payments because I know the guys have worked at practices where you do it differently and sometimes cash flow can become an issue, if you're waiting for a certain stage to end and the client sort of won't allow that stage to end by won't allowing you to conclude your design. So you can end up it's stuck in the mud sometimes.
Or waiting for the planning consent or something.
Planners can hold it up for a period of time.
The biggest enemy, isn't it, to an architecture practice is cash flow.
100%. So that was something that we done, wasn't it? It was we started to we'd set our fee out, but then we'd say, let's just draw down on it monthly regardless. And that seemed to help.
So the only question, because we are very much, as I said, very much aligned on that principle. So we structure our fees against the RIBA stages, but we don't adhere to them in terms of how the fee's drawn down. It is more of a monthly retainer. However, we are often forced into a fee cap. So it's an overall figure that we draw down from. But by the sounds of what you said there, Magnus, is that you don't necessarily cap your fees. You just agree this monthly. And then if the thing drags on, you've got a right then to continue that retainer. Is that right? Is that what you were getting at?
That's right. Because what happened is, like, you know, you've got a project that's going to take 24 months on site, and we've got one project that's got 6 months delays on it at the moment. Mostly it's because of the client decisions. Why should we fit the bill for that? We can't do that. I still got to pay the guys the same salary. We're still going to pay for our offices, and everyone's going to eat.
Yeah,
so, you know, we can't cap the fee because it's just impossible. And, you know, I have one architect friend who he just does everything on a percentage, and he refuses to do anything else. So the cost goes up, his fees goes up, and he just does that. And if people don't like it, that's tough. But, you know, that's kind of that. You can only do that when you have a certain level of reputation and a certain kind of, clout, I suppose, and confidence in doing that. But I think it's important that you have mechanisms in the contract that allows for changes and how it goes forward. And it's the same thing why we normally would do a kickoff meeting. For example, at stage four, we do a kickoff meeting and saying, this is how we're going to run it. This is how we have to run it to make it make sense. So if you're not making decisions, for example, or you want to defer choosing that, then you can, but it's going to cost you more money in the end.
Spot on.
Amazing piece of advice, that.
Yeah. And you just touched on stage four there. And again, it's something that we discovered that we're quite aligned with you on. Is the splitting of stage four into stage 4A and stage 4B. Something that in the Reba plan of work, it just all comes under stage four, but we've found it's quite difficult to pin, especially if you're going to be novated to a contractor in the delivery phase. It's quite difficult to pin down who's going to own those fees. So that's why we split it out to stage 4A and stage 4B. Yeah. I don't know, this was something that you were really keen to do early on when we started the practice.
Just because stage four is too long, isn't it? It's too long to just be in the one stage. So again, I might have pinched this from you a while ago, but we split ours into 4A and B as well. And I suppose the point of this little segment is to just, if you could just add a bit of, almost add a little bit more context to our way of thinking is 4A is for regulations and kind of pricing. So it's pre-contracted appointments. And then 4B then is, there's a contracted appointed, but then it's in the running to start on site. Well, so just to add to that, what was your, I don't know, we're getting a little bit specific, but I suppose, again, we have got listeners who would be interested in this. What was your ethos to splitting them?
Well, I mean, I think for us as well as, like, when we do many of our houses, we do a fee, we do a service where we do a full interior package as well. So there will be, I mean, one of the packages that takes an enormous amount of time is the bathrooms, kitchen, joinery, staircases, fireplaces, all of those things. It's such a big package that takes a lot of time, and it also can affect the budget massively. So, for example, to give you some figures, I would say on an average project, if you got the shell and core costs, we would say that the fit-out might be, 25% on top of that. But we're doing one project where the fit-out is well over 100% of that. So for a client to kind of test the market and get a tender cost for the shell and core a little bit earlier can be beneficial. And then also, when you're then moving into your stage 4B, there's inevitably going to be contracted design item, like a CDPS, contracted design portion for, staircases, fireplaces, joinery. So if we can start working with a contracted preferred joinery company, then we can shortcut in many situations, so many valuable conversations. But we're also trying to, reduce the number of contracted design portions, because we don't want an AV consultant to come in when we're on site and then suddenly they're going to start putting speakers in, and then they're going to clash with ducts and lighting that's already been coordinated, and we're going to have to coordinate everything once again. So it just gives us a little bit more flexibility in the tendering process, and it can also speed up the process, because if the client is willing to accept that, we can get a shell and core cost and we can attack the fit-out package a little bit later. But again, it's got to do with how you're going to tender it as well, I think. Having a good cost consultant involved throughout that process, so you don't feel like you're getting shafted on the stage 4B after you selected a contractor. But as I said, how you tender it, we do, you know, 95% of everything we do is a traditional contract, and the rest of it is some form of management contract. So we don't do any DMB really. So we design everything to keep the control. But yeah, that split has worked quite well for us now. It's something we're going forward for on all projects.
Yeah,
that's quite interesting. Yeah, very interesting. Just in terms of moving forward then, so, you know, you touched on earlier the direction that the company is now looking to move forward into, maybe the hospitality sector. I really admire your project, the Neva project, 1-5 and Neva 6 in the Turks and Caicos. And that's obviously it's in a difficult environment, that, but the houses are still very much, even though there's six of them and it's not like a one-off super home, they very much still have got that strong stamp on them. But just in terms of where you're moving the business forward to and your motivations now at this stage of your career, you know, you're multi-award winning, you are seen as a bit of a thought leader, I would say. So what would your motivations be for the next, say, 5-10 years?
Well, I mean, I think that... For me, I turned 50 this year as well. So, I'm starting to get on a bit. I'm not a young architect anymore, I suppose. But I think that, you know, there comes a time as well as like a practice. You think that, you know, there's been a hard slog, right? I've done this for 13 years now, and it's been hard work. And I can't say we've made masses of money or anything. It would be nice to start, you know, to feel that, to attack the business side a little bit of it and think about, you know, I'm got 15 years to retirement, right? Not that I think I'll retire in that traditional sense, but I've got to start thinking about what's the next kind of thing and how the business can develop. And I think it's very interesting for us how we can start doing this bigger project and trying to, because they're going to bring us greater financial security, but then it also means that we'll have we can perhaps drop some of the one-off houses we do, because some of the smaller ones we find very difficult to make them work financially for us. For me, that's kind of how it's going. More of the hospitality, more residential developers, schemes, and so on, in a kind of a high-end sector. And the other thing I was going to touch on briefly was that I think the international market is also very, very interesting for us. We have done work now in 10, 11 countries, I think. It's hugely rewarding to work overseas for several reasons. Number one, I think, is that if a one-off house client comes to you, they to go overseas for your choice of architect, it means that they almost have more respect for you and what you say, because they made that extra effort. Because they know, of course, it would be easier if you hired an architect at home. But that means that very often with some of international clients, we have much more in-depth dialogues on architecture on academic level, so to speak. And that's really interesting. And you develop these relationships with clients. That's fantastic. And the other thing is that you get to go travel around the world in a way, and you get to see these fantastic places that mean a lot to people. There's places where they grew up, where they got their childhood connection to it, so having been to, I mean, what do we do at the moment? We're doing some fabulous sites in Stockholm, a beautiful site in the Finnish archipelago. We're doing, obviously, Turks and Caicos. We're doing this beautiful site, two sites in the States. They're both equally beautiful. One is on a little cove close to Newport. One is up in the Virginia in the mountains, up in Shenandoah Mountains. It's just stunning to be able to do that. It's and have those dialogues with clients and go and spend time with them and get to know them. It's super, super rewarding. And I think that when you go really and really niche as we are, I mean, the UK is a quite big market, but still there are not that many houses that are being built every year of that kind of caliber of the works you want. So I think that having an international reach means that you've got a bigger forest to collect all your firewood, so to speak.
Yeah, it's a good analogy.
Well, in terms of your international reach then, have you got to that audience in the same way that you've described previous? Again, social media, working on, you know, getting your stuff out there in publications, or has there been a slightly different strategy?
Yeah. No, it's exactly the same one. I remember, you know, maybe 6-7 years ago, I saw this architect that had all the international work on the website, and I contacted them and I said, how did you get all of this work? And he goes like, oh, I don't know. It just kind of one thing happens and then another thing happens. And then
it took a couple of years and the same thing started to happen for us. And that's just almost been an organic and it just happened.
Yeah. So advice for other people with I'm clinging on to that idea of niching as well, because that's something that we've debated, isn't it? Do we try and be an architect for everybody, or do we try and niche down into a certain specialism? And you know, obviously you guys have clearly carved that niche out. But if they haven't got that first project, again, your advice there, you created a fictitious one in that kind of niche that you wanted to grow into as well. So again, would that be a bit of advice for others? Yeah, you know, if they've got a real aspiration in getting into a market, but they're struggling to get that first portfolio breakthrough, is simply create something in your own vision and hopefully that'll go somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that very much is key. You need to kind of define what it is that you want to do, and you need to be kind of relentless in pursuing that. And I remember when I set up, I have known other chap that set up practice at a very similar time to me, and he was growing quicker than I did when we did, and so on. But they were taking on work that I didn't want to do. I didn't want to do the small extension, so I turned them down, and it meant that we stayed smaller for a longer period. But then as we kind of got more known, that kind of accelerated. So we then kind of started to accelerate quicker. And I think that if you stick to your guns, I think you're going to be in a more powerful position a little bit later on. Sometimes it might be painful, but I think sometimes you've got to take a couple of punches to get where you want to in the right way. So, yeah. I was going to say one more thing on the niche thing. I think that, you know, if you look at a company like, you know, I remember when I just set up my practice, for example, MK27, who I'm a great admirer of their works in Brazil. So Marcio Kogan, they in 2009, they published a house in Brazil called the Parachi House, which kind of blew me away. I thought, like, this is the absolute the DB, as they say. It just kind of blew me away. And I looked at their, you know, you looked at their website, and they might have like 6 to 8 houses on their website. And they've had this kind of trajectory now where they're doing houses all over the world, but they're also doing, you know, they're doing hotels and hospitality. They've done the Brazilian Pavilion. But, you know, looking at their resorts they've done in the Maldives, for example, is just stunning, in my opinion. And I can see their work kind of, you know, we've come up against them twice now in different things. And it's kind of really interesting how, you start to kind of almost be a competition to your heroes. For me, it was kind of, it's extremely flattering. And that trajectory they've had, it's interesting to see how that's grown into the hospitality. And I can see, like, we're doing the same thing, but on a completely different scale and fame level to them, of course. But yeah, it's exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds great. Just a quick question, a little bit off piece from me. Do you have any other investments? So obviously architecture's your passion and your original business, but have you branched out into other sectors? Do you work with any other small companies? And just that level of businessman now that you've become through running a successful architecture practice, have you been able to apply that to anything else?
No, I haven't at all. All my eggs are in this basket, I'm afraid. I think that, you know, the only other project I suppose every architect have is their own house, you know, which you keep adding on money and you keep moving and doing stuff to your houses. If I had more free cash, I would do some development for sure, you know. And it's kind of, you see that there is some people that have done some very interesting business plans out there when they collaborate with developers and actually don't take much fee. They just take a share in the project profits later on. And I think that it's something I would love to do, is to collaborate with clients and, you know, go in on almost a no fee if we just for sharing the project for a higher reward in the end.
Yeah. And that's why I asked, because obviously I think it's just in the mind of every practice owner, isn't it? That like, we work in a time-based industry and you can only charge so much for that. You know, you can always put your rates up and stuff, but you can only ever get so far with it. So I think it's just innate in us somewhere that there's always, the three of us have always had an idea of, we'd want to do our own development, very similar to what you're talking about there, whether it be, you know, we get our own money somehow, and then we've done our own ideal development. I mean, we were talking about buying a plot of land and putting three of our own houses next door to each other on it, and just having like a private.
We'll get you to design them.
Yeah. Little estate for the three of us and stuff. So, but yeah, I was just interested just to know whether you'd ever been pulled away from it in terms financially, and you'd looked at other revenue streams and stuff.
But I still think there's value in that, though. When you said no, basically. Well, you've still carved out, a very successful business. They look like the projects now. Now, this is easy for me to say, but no such thing as a smooth job. But the jobs, they look very rewarding as well. Is that fair to say? Just because of the quality of them. The Barcelona one, for example, you must have been absolutely buzzing when you saw the results of that.
I see this. Some projects are very rewarding. Some are very frustrating. I think it's very rare that you have a project that kind of you just smash it out of the park kind of thing. I mean, one project that we did that really was like that was a project for a client, a structural engineer, actually. So we did a whole holiday home for them. And, we designed, got planning, built it in 18 months. And it was just beautiful process. And it was cost what the cost plan said. And it was just... it was just a dream. Whereas then we have, projects that has gone through COVID and gone through 30% cost inflation through, cost of living crisis. And then you end up redesign and doing things for, just to get it over the line and stuff. So sometimes it's very hard work. It's very hard work. But I think that it's always rewarding when you come to see the projects and when you see them finished. And I think when you come back to a project after having been so deeply involved, when you're there, you just see everything that is not 100% how you wanted it. But when you come back to it, maybe 6 months later or a year later, you see it for what it is. And then you're going to go like, wow. And I think that the thing, I mean, last year we took the whole office to Barcelona for our office trip. So we just finished a house there. So the whole office went there. And I think that the thing I'm always trying to explain as well about the process is that when you design something, and we have this process of editing out stuff. And I think that as a young architect, you have a tendency to perhaps put in too much stuff, too many of your ideas. So sometimes you just got to get rid of some stuff. And the more you get rid of, the more what's left becomes more pure. It becomes much stronger. And we call it like, it's essentialism. This great book by a British chap called Greg McKeown, and talking about how you can get rid of all this noise in your life and you live an essentialist lifestyle. And the same thing with the architecture. I'm not talking about minimalism, but I'm talking about getting rid of stuff that you don't need. And so you have a few things then that become so much more powerful, but then all those details come together. They might be the choice of materials, the details, the view, or how the wind goes through the building and everything. When all of that comes together, it becomes a whole where everything is together that's so much more powerful than each part individually. And that's something really magic when you get that feeling. I call it the je ne sais quoi of building, the thing that you cannot touch. So when we went to Barcelona, the whole office is like in the bus joking there and stuff like that. And then they all piled into the house and everyone just went absolutely quiet. And it was just like you could drop a pin in here. And everyone was just like sauntering around, walking around on their own and just looking like, looking around. And it was like the building had this effect on them because it just kind of, you took their breath away in a way. And I think that if you can achieve that quality in the architecture, that then you're onto something. And it's the same thing, I can't compare myself to the cathedral designers, but the experience is that, when you walk into a cathedral or a great church or a space, you go, wow. And it's that space of what you created. That is so much more. And to create that stillness, I think is something that kind of amazes me every time. And how you can be that is the most rewarding part of the whole process. I think it's when you achieve that, and when your client sends you pictures. I got lots of my clients on WhatsApp, and they send you pictures. They're sitting on the terrace at night, and they're just kind of that's very rewarding.
Yeah, and that's a perfect answer. It's exactly yeah. exactly what I was trying to almost draw from you was the. Sometimes we get messages through all our various channels, mainly obviously on Arcademia, where some are telling us that we're inspiring to be architects and some are asking us, is there any point in continuing and stuff? And we're always trying to bang the drum that, You know, the point of being an architect is exactly what you've just described. That result, there aren't many professions that give you that feeling, are there, at the result. That's the point of being an architect. And that's one of the key messages that we're trying to get across. So, yeah.
That's your motivation every morning, isn't it?
Yeah.
Even if you're working on a project that's really frustrating, you're stuck in the mud, you're struggling mentally to get past things on it. If you wake up every morning with that, but when I create this at the end, there's going to be a space that people are going to stand in, and that feeling of that stillness and that awe that people are in when they're in your space, yeah, that's motivation enough to keep cracking on.
Yeah, spot on.
Just while we're on, we're obviously talking about Barcelona House there. One thing that I wanted to ask you, and we're going to ask like every guest this that we have on as a practice owner, is just two quick questions on what's your favorite project at Strom, so that you for whatever reason, the one that sits in your heart the most. And then outside of that, just generally in architecture, I know you mentioned the Treehouse in Brazil earlier. What's your favorite building and who's your favorite architect, just generally?
Oh, I think that's always a difficult question. I mean, when I was in university, I studied a lot of Corbusier and Zumthor. But, you know, as I mentioned earlier, Farnsworth House, when I discovered Farnsworth House, that did something very interesting to me. Although I was never that massive Mesian fan, but Farnsworth House was something that was very special for me. And all those, you know, the Stahl House in LA, which is kind of, I suppose you can feel a little bit of that in the Barcelona House, the Pierre Koenig Sheets Goldstein House, Lautner, and the Brazilians that are working today, I think, are fabulous. You know, MK27, Jacobson Arquitectura, Isai Weinfeld, Arthur Casas, they will do stuff that I think is pretty amazing at the moment. I mean, the modernism works really well in that climate as well. So I think that's very successful. Some people would say it's still hanging on to modernism in some way, but it's a contemporary version of it that I think works really well. Of our own jobs, I mean, I think the Quest is always going to be very special because it was one of the first kind of one-off houses that we did, and it was very successful in itself for the practice. I mean, at the moment, we've got so many exciting things that are, you know, Meadow House is almost completed. I mean, that's very special as well because it's something where we've done the hall with interiors and everything. And I think that's something that's going to be really special. And Barcelona feels very special as well. And we've got a very special one. I mean, there's so many of them. I think that it's very hard to say, oh, that project's my favorite. There is elements of every project that have something almost magic about it, I think. And I could say things about each project that makes it special in the way that, you know, I mean, the America ones, the Finland ones, the Sweden ones. There's so many. I can't say how this is approached because we're all trying to have a very high standard for all of them. So I think that there's different elements to each one that is special. That so it's not like, you know, you have favorites of your children in a way. You know, you love different things about them sometimes.
Yeah. Oh,
fair point.
Yeah. And then coming towards the end now. So I suppose we've sort of touched on what I wanted to ask you to sort of finish on, but because we've just generally sort of meandered our way through your journey and stuff. But as a final message, what do you think the keys to success would be? So for a large portion of our audience, even if they're just starting out, you know, maybe their end goal is to, you know, what, one day run a practice, you know, whether it's going to be similar in style to Strom or RBA or whatever it might be. But what would your keys to success be?
I think there are several points to that question. Several answers to that question. I would say, like, the first one is, like I said earlier, you need to figure out what your destination is, where do you want to go? And then, you know, of course, there's numerous ways of getting there. The other one is, like, I think it's like specialize, be niche. I think that's a quicker way to kind of get the market share of something. I would just say, like, you know, if you want a very super minimal white house, where do you go? Or will you go to John Paulson? Or if you're med, you go to Fran Silvestre. That's why he's got 1.2 million followers on Instagram, right? Because he's got a super small niche, but he dominates it. The other thing I think is that, you know, surround yourself with talented people. You can't do all the work yourself. You've got to learn to delegate. That's not always easy, but you've got to learn to do that. And then just not people in your practice, but also have outside advice. I mean, I've seen a professional mentor who specializes in architecture and creative businesses for 5-6 years. And then after that, we also took on a business consultant 2 years ago. And that just really helped us to sort out our kind of, you know, more strategic things about how our office is structured and finances and budget planning and stuff like that. So we got great confidence in the business. And as I said, the other thing is like portfolio. If you don't have the work in your portfolio, create the work in your portfolio. And I would say also don't accept something being mediocre. I think that you've got to keep pushing. And, you know, and I think that sometimes as a business owner, you have to. It was an interesting article on LinkedIn the other day that talked about ego. Is it a bad thing to have ego as an architect? And, you know, some people think it's like a bad thing and some people think it's a good thing. I think you've got to have a certain amount of ego. For example, when we're doing this competition in the Middle East for these 60 houses, we had three different building types. And, you know, I was sketching and we had some great ideas for the houses. And then I come in one day and I said, right, we're ditching these two houses completely. And everyone goes like, what? It's like, yeah, they're not good enough. So we started over and, you know, and that means that, you know, that's me sitting up late at night very often doing those initial concepts. But I think that you got to be strong enough to kind of stick to your guns and say what's good and what's not good enough. And that's sometimes when it's like, sometimes running a business is like Rick Mather used to say, this is not a democracy. And, you know, it is kind of, it sounds a little bit harsh, but I think sometimes you need to be determined, because if you got 12 people deciding where you're going, you're all going to row in the different directions. You all need to row in the same direction. And someone needs to tell you where the direction is. So you have a clear vision, vision and purpose. Yeah. That's a long answer.
No, honestly, absolutely amazing. Just to sort of add to that, won't name names, it's only a handful of jobs, but sometimes we say that clients can sometimes be their own worst enemy. Because you say that there's so many different ideas, so many different directions. And personally, and this is a bit of advice that I've took from you both following you for many a year, and obviously this session as well, is the importance of sticking to your guns. As you say, just with that little bit of ego, that little bit of confidence to say, this is my way. And I think, as you say, if that puts a client off, you will soon attract the right sort of clients that will buy into your philosophy. And you clearly I think you epitomise that philosophy, that strategy, that, again, it's somewhat of a style, and it's obviously reaped the reward. So I think that's going to be one of the biggest pieces of advice, yeah. I think, from this.
Yeah, and when you're doing a house, for example, there's always going to be things where you don't agree with the client. You know, there are things that I will compromise on, and there's things that I won't compromise on, I think. You know, if someone says like, oh, do you know what, just for a bad example, what should we do? Can we put in plastic windows? And I would say like, no, I can't do that. that would make me kind of, it would make me kind of resign from the job kind of thing, you know? Yeah. And you know what? We've added clauses to our contracts allowing us to resign for aesthetic differences.
Wow, that's interesting.
That's something we need to put into ours.
No, but I think that's really interesting.
They shouldn't happen, but when if a client comes and says like, you know, stick some Doric columns on here, and I'll say like, sorry, I can't do that. And, you know, there's very few provisions in the contract to terminate. But if we're not compatible, there's no point doing it, because I can't do the best thing for you. You can't do the best thing for me. So that is something that's important. What were we talking about just before that?
No, it was just one of the biggest takeaways out of this session is sticking to your guns. And I think you yourself and your practice are one of the best examples out there, I think, for sticking to your guns. And the fact that your website even states that process, that you've got a piece there that says, you know, there's our philosophy, to kind of take it or leave it. And I think, again, I think that will only result in positive things in the long run, even if there's as you've mentioned, maybe a little bit of short-term pain. I think in the long run, you'll benefit from it. And I bet your staff appreciate that philosophy as well that you instill in projects. I bet you they have a better working environment as a result of that.
Yeah, I think so, because it means that you are kind of rowing in the same direction and so on. But I think also like it's like what I just remember what I was going to say is that thing. There are certain things that you won't compromise if it affects the integrity of the building. But if someone says that, you know what, I want this piece of furniture that my grandmother had, and it's important to me, even if I think it's hideous, you know. who might argue with that? If I don't like it, I'll move it when I photograph the building.
Yeah.
You know, or if they want to do the guest loo, you know, if they want to clad it in, you know, I don't know, clad it in cotton wool on the inside or fake plastic roses, let them do that, right? Because I just don't photograph that room, or we won't flaunt it because it doesn't affect the integrity of the building. It's just a quirk. If someone wants a quirk, let people have quirks, right? Who am I to decide that they can't have that? Because it's their houses, their homes. So there's a balance between what people want and what is personal, you know, and people have lives and they have things that they bring with them. People curate it very often in our buildings, I think. But there is, don't compromise on the big stuff, but on the small stuff, you know, does it matter sometimes?
Yeah.
I suppose it's very clear what you're signing up for when you appoint your practice. So you're not getting a Redrow home, you're getting a Strom home, and
yeah,
that is very clear on the site. So it probably is very rare that you'd then be having an argument about plastic windows.
Yeah, it's very rare. I mean, it's happened on a few projects and certain things, but it's not something that kills it by any means, you know. And we just work with real people, right? And we've got to be able to work on a human level as well.
Yeah.
That's a very important point that we didn't touch on too much, is that human level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to be able to work with people on a human level and make sure your personalities don't clash too much.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another important aspect.
We've said before, haven't we, buildings are easy to a degree, people are hard.
Yeah, well, buildings are what we do. So yeah, buildings come easy to us, but it's sometimes the people that are hard. Exactly that. Like that was a mantra that we had for a little while, wasn't it? But yeah, no, spot on. Magnus, I just want to congratulate you on what a fantastic company you've got and how well you've done.
Thank you.
Thanks everyone for watching. Don't forget to like and subscribe. We'll put the links below for Strom Architects' Instagram, LinkedIn, and website. So definitely don't forget to check them out, and we'll see you next time.